Now, he has already told us that our ideas may be external or internal, originate from sensation or introspection. There are simple ideas of sensation, for instance, that something is solid. The idea of solidity is a simple idea that's external. A simple idea of introspection would be the idea of reasoning, judging, or willing. But the most interesting thing about us, of course, are not our simple ideas, solidity out there, willing in here, but the complex ideas that we have. Where do complex ideas come from? And I'll put it very simply. It isn't important that we look at all the details here, but Locke said our complex ideas are either compounds, bipolarized relations, or abstractions. This bipolarization is Dr. Bahnsen's way of putting it. Sometimes we take two simple ideas, we compound them. Okay? We bring them together. Sometimes we take two simple ideas and we keep them bipolarized. We put them in relationship to each other. And thirdly, the mind sometimes separates one idea from all those that accompany it in real existence. And this is what we know as abstraction. As I'm holding an apple in front of me, the real existence of the apple brings a number of ideas to me simultaneously, right? Roundness, redness, you know, pulpiness, whatever. And then what I do through an operation of abstraction is that I get general ideas from the apple, the idea of roundness, redness. But I never see roundness or redness. I always see the particular apple. So our compound ideas come about, our complex ideas come about through compounding, bipolarization, relational, or abstraction. Locke also said there is within us a power to observe in ourselves repeating of ideas one after another. And so as an illustration, Locke would distinguish between the idea of infinite space and the idea of the infinity of space. And how would he draw that distinction? Well, none of us have ever had an experience of infinite space, have we? Whoa, you'd have to have a pretty big mind to experience that. But you can nevertheless come up with the idea of the infinity of space. How? Well, I have the idea of space, this wall to this wall, right? And now my mind can repeat that idea. Okay, so through introspection, I take that unit of space and I repeat it. And then I take the next unit and I repeat it and repeat it and repeat it. And so I can have an idea of the infinity of space, which is essentially the making of local things bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. But I don't ever have an idea or an experience of infinite space. So there is the power of repetition of our ideas within us. Well, now we need to pay attention to a very important idea. What is Locke's analysis of the idea of substance? This is crucial. As I taught you before, the general idea of substance is an unperceived substratum for the perceived qualities of things. The idea of substance. And I'm going to read to you from Locke directly here. He speaks of not imagining how these simple ideas, red, round, pulpy, can subsist by themselves, and so we accustom ourselves to supposing some substratum. So he understands why we speak of it. There has got to be something that brings these qualities together into what we call an apple. However, the notion of pure substance in general he says, has no other idea of it at all, has no origin and experience. The notion of substance is a supposition of he knows not what. Okay? So Locke, what is a substance? It's a substratum. Well, what's that? I know not what. We come to have ideas of particular sorts of substances, he said, by collecting such combinations of simple ideas as are, by experience and observation of men's senses, taken notice of to exist together, and are therefore supposed to flow from the particular internal constitution or unknown essence of that substance. Because why do we speak of the substance apple? Because we have all of these qualities, these simple qualities, which we're accustomed to experiencing together in our experience. And so we speak of a substratum for the red, round, pulpiness, all of which are separate qualities. And he says, whatever substantial forms we may talk of have no other idea of those substances than what is framed by a collection of those simple ideas which are found in them. That is, substance is nothing more than the collecting of the simple ideas found in them. However, substances not only are the collection point for these isolated ideas, red, round, pulpiness, but generally men think of substances as causing changes in other substances. But now Locke said, do we observe the production of change one substance to another? Let's forget the apple for a minute, the billiard ball example. Do we actually see the cue ball go across the table and cause the eight ball to move the other way across, well, further down the table when it is struck? According to him, we have the idea of alteration. That's what we experience in sensation. We have the eight ball sitting here, then there's alteration of its position. We see one event, the cue ball going across the table. We see another event, the alteration of the position of the eight ball. What we experience is transfer then, not production of motion. We see the change in motion, but not the production of motion. And so where do we get the idea of causality? Listen closely, because David Hume is going to get rid of this later. Locke says we get the idea of agency, or the idea of an active power producing change, from introspection. From introspection. The idea of the beginning of motion we have only from reflection on what passes in ourselves, where we find by experience that barely by willing it, barely by the thought of the mind, we can move the parts of our bodies which were before at rest. This is really important. What Locke is saying is, I observe within myself causality because I will things. Now notice, just by a thought of the mind, I've changed the position of this glass. I picked it up. And so the notion of causality comes from an internal analogy of will. However, causality is not just change of location with a production of motion. Causality implies a universal, well, it implies a necessity to this change. To say that X causes Y is, when you use the word cause, is to say that X always causes Y, not just, well, today the cue ball made the eight ball go across the table. If you say the cue ball caused the eight ball, what you're saying is that's always the case, because it's causal. So where do we get this idea of necessity or universality? It's one thing to say we reason by internal analogy that there's a cause, a production of the change of the... that is, we get the idea of the production of change from within ourselves. But where do we get the idea of a universal or necessary change comes about? Locke says, the mind takes notice of how one thing comes to an end and ceases to be, and another begins to exist which was not before, and concludes from what it has so constantly observed to have been, that the like changes will for the future be made in the same things by like agents and by like ways. Now, I know it's getting close to your lunchtime, but I still have to ask you to pay attention. What was the salient word there? The mind concludes this. We don't have an idea of necessity of change, or if you will, universality. X always causes Y. But rather, from the constant observance of that sort of thing, we conclude with that necessity. And so now let's go back. I said we're going to give an analysis of substance, and I'm going to give you a brief summary now of what Locke said about substance and all of its complexity. According to Locke, the idea of any particular substance, an apple, contains, first of all, simple ideas of certain properties. Okay? What ideas would they be? Red, round, pulpy. Secondly, we also have confused ideas of a I know not what. Confused ideas of a somewhat of some sort that is the substratum of these properties. I'm not done yet, but let's just make sure we're building this up. To know the apple, to know the substance of the apple, is first to have clear ideas of its properties, but then to have a confused idea of a substratum that holds these properties together, and thirdly, an idea of cause, an idea of cause. This apple can cause things, like a billiard ball can cause things. This substance, the apple, can cause things, and the idea of cause is analyzable into the idea of succession. You get that from sensation. We see succession, right? The cue ball was here, then the eight ball moved over there. Okay, so we see two events in succession. Secondly, we have the idea of agency. From an analogy of introspection, we have the idea of the production of change. Just like my will has changed something, I apply to the billiard balls this internal introspective notion. And thirdly, I have the idea of necessity, which is not part of my experience at all, but is just a conclusion from my experience. Well, those of you who know a little bit about the history of philosophy, can't you see how Locke has just set himself up for Hume to come along and say, oh, excuse me, you concluded that there's a necessity here? But we're empiricists. We're supposed to trace all of our ideas back to their origin. So you can't say that necessity comes as a conclusion of thought, because if it's only a conclusion of thought, it has no basis. It's not tested by experience. If you had understood what I just said, and only in a minimal way do I expect that you do, but if you really clearly got what I just said, we could, in a sense, close the books and go home. That finishes British empiricism. Because Locke, you see, doesn't have any basis then for the doctrine of substance or causation, because he's not being true to his own empirical epistemology. Of course, the basic trouble in Locke's analysis of substance is his assumption that all of our ideas are simple elements. That is, Locke looked for simple units of sensation or simple units of reflection. But if you stop and think about it, this is not true to experience at all. Isn't that ironic? Here you have the empiricists who say we got to get out and experience the world. We want factuality, not just this mathematical rationality for the world. We want factuality. We want to go out and observe, know the world. But if you'll stop and think about it, my friends, you'll notice that you do not observe simples. You observe objects, don't you? Has anybody had an observation of redness? No. You'll always tell me what? I've observed red things, red color patches or something like that, but no one has ever observed a simple thing like red or round. That's not true to experience at all. And yet Locke was looking, what? For the origin of ideas with the notion that our basic ideas are simples. But our basic ideas are not simples. They're always organized objects. The world of ordinary experience is not the world that was analyzed by the empiricist. They were dealing with an abstraction. Now, what is our general criticism of the rationalist? They were being abstract. They were not being true to experience. And in their own way, the empiricists were also being abstract rather than true to experience. Locke, you see, was offering us a logical order, trying to show how simple things can be compounded into objects, how round, red, pulpy can be compounded into the idea of an apple. But he was not, as he thought, giving us the historical plane method, because historically we don't go from simple to complex. We do what? We go from complex to simple. We start with a complex object, an apple, and then we divide it into its simple parts, color, shape, texture, and so forth. Locke was offering us then a rational reconstruction of experience rather than talking about experience. And I do hope, if not today, the day will come and you'd understand how utterly significant that criticism Dr. Bonken just gave is. Empiricism does not go to experience then to give us a theory of knowledge. It gives us a rational reconstruction of experience. One more criticism of Locke's plain historical method. You notice that as Locke is explaining to us our ideas, we are always running into terms like collect. We collect ideas. Or something suggests itself to us. Or we infer. Or we conclude. Now let's ask ourselves, is collecting, suggesting, inferring, and concluding something we experience in sensation or reflection? When we collect round, red, pulpy into appleness, do we experience either externally or internally a collecting procedure? Well, not at all. And so Locke wasn't being true to his own empiricism, because he was using ideas that did not have an empirical foundation. And yet he tells us that the world, we begin our experience of the world with a blank tablet. And no programming of the computer either. Remember that. So what lesson do we draw from this, sports fans? Anybody who says we begin only with sensations, only with experiences, doesn't have any way to bind the experiences together, does he? If you take that seriously and you reject everything that's not experienced, we don't observe the logical process itself, we don't observe the collecting process of the mind, therefore we have no right to refer to it, and so all you have are what? Loose, disjointed experiences. The empiricists take us away from this speculative nonsense of the dream philosophy of the rationalist, but they throw us out into a chance world of unconnected particulars. And they, of course, now Locke Barclay, they are willing to say the mind collects them, all the while telling us the mind doesn't have anything in it that isn't experienced. So what they want is their cake and they want to eat it too, but they can't. They use their empirical epistemology, but they don't do it truthfully. They don't do it consistently and honestly. And if you did do it consistently and honestly, what would you end up with? You'd never have objects of experience. You'd never have causality. You'd never have any unity between experiences. And every time I say this, I want you to remember, David Hume is waiting right out here in the wings, ready to run on stage, saying, "That's my cue! I want to do an empirical approach to knowledge better than Locke and Berkeley." And he does. He finally gets rid of, you see, they didn't realize they were holding on to these things. He finally gets rid of those principles of unity and connection and substance and causality. And what are you left with? Can't know anything. You simply can't know anything. Okay, let's talk about his theory of Locke's theory of knowledge. We've talked about his psychology of knowing, all ideas derived from experience. Now, his theory of knowledge itself, first of all, Locke felt there were degrees of cognitive adequacy. 3 degrees of cognitive adequacy. He spoke of intuitive knowledge, demonstrative knowledge, and sensitive knowledge. Sensitive knowledge. There are really 3 degrees, then, of knowing. The highest degree is intuitive. Intuitive knowledge is knowledge of what is immediately certain and cannot be doubted. Here's your Cartesian indubitable. The second level is demonstrative knowledge, which amounts to a chain of intuitions. A chain of intuitions. So though you don't immediately see the indubitable character of some conclusion, you can back it up through a number of other intuitions, if you will, chain them together, and finally then you have demonstrated the conclusion. And then thirdly, there is sensitive knowledge, ideas we have that don't have any necessary relationships between them at all. That is the knowledge we have through sensation, obviously. And Locke said we should really call this faith or opinion rather than knowledge. I have an opinion, you know, from this sensation and so forth, but I haven't got any necessary relations that I'm drawing to draw this conclusion. So it's not demonstrative, and it's certainly not something that is indubitable. So it's not at the highest level. What are the objects of knowledge? Crucial point. Get this in your notes. According to Locke, the mind knows nothing but its own states. The mind can only know the ideas which are inside itself. It only knows its own states. In saying this, Locke bypasses a major problem. If the mind knows only its own states, how can it know to what real existence those ideas are related? According to him, we know ideas, which is the state of mind. Ideas are supposed to represent the external world. But if the mind only knows its ideas, how can it know anything about the objects that are supposed to be represented by these ideas? And on this, Locke simply ignored the whole difficulty. He just assumed that ideas, as a matter of fact, represent their real existence. That is, the objects outside themselves. But I want you to stop and think about this. Let me summarize for you. Locke doesn't say that you know the apple. Okay, I have an apple out here on the first table, imagine. Locke says, I don't know the object. I don't know the apple. What do I know? I know an idea of the apple. The idea is what mediates between me and the object. So, the question is, how can I be sure that this idea properly or accurately represents the object of which it is the idea? And my criticism, and I want you to get this because you're going to give it back to me, is that Locke never addressed the problem. He just skirted it. He just took it for granted. Well, of course ideas represent their objects. But you see, you can ask questions about that. You say, well, if I only know my ideas, then in a sense, I'm epistemologically cut off from the world, aren't I? I just have to hope that the ideas that get in here do, in fact, represent the objects outside. Well, what are those real objects that are out there? Let's move on. According to Locke, there are three types of real existence. There are selves, there's God, and there are bodies. Of course, that sounds a lot like Descartes too, doesn't it? We have a body, we have a self, and we have a God. Now, how do we know these things? I've already told you about the three levels of cognitive adequacy. Well, you'll like this. How do we know our own existence? Locke says we know it intuitively. That's at that level of it's indubitable, intuitive knowledge. How do we know God's existence? He said demonstratively. We can prove God's existence. We know ourselves to exist intuitively. We know God to exist by demonstration. And we know physical things to exist only by sensitive knowledge. So it turns out these three levels of cognitive adequacy very nicely match up with I'm certain of my own existence, God is demonstrable, it's a little less clear, but we can bring it together, and about physical objects, I have only opinion, I only have sensitive knowledge. Now, how can we know that the objects that we have ideas of exist while we're looking at them and feeling them? Okay, I have a glass here that I've been using for a couple days as an illustration. How do I know that this exists while I'm feeling it? Can I demonstrate that it exists? Locke said, no, I cannot demonstrate by necessary relationships, I cannot prove logically that this glass exists. And then he added, but nobody, and I'm quoting, nobody can in earnest be so skeptical as to be uncertain of its existence. How do you like that? Remember, I told you somebody's waiting in the wings, right? David Hume. No one can be that skeptical? Hume says, let me try. See, Locke tells us his empirical epistemology, and this is a lesson for all those who are tempted to be evidential and empirical in their apologetic, too. Locke thought, well, we can all, have this empirical epistemology in common. Okay, well, can you prove that this glass exists, given your approach? He said, well, no, I can't prove it. But no one could doubt that. What happens when you run into somebody who says, hey, I'm willing to be just that skeptical. I don't think you can know that. But here's another thing. How do I know that this glass existed when I wasn't experiencing it? Yesterday we all went home after class. I came back this morning. The glass is here. I believe that it existed when I wasn't looking at it, when we were all gone from the room. How do I know that? Locke said, the continued existence of what I'm not experiencing is known highly probably. Okay? So let's talk about the things that you can know, given this empirical approach. Can you know that you exist? Oh, yeah, intuitively. That's at the highest level of cognitive adequacy. Well, can I know that God exists? Demonstratively, because you can prove God's existence through a chain of reasoning. Can I know that physical objects exist? Sensitively. Yes, I can have sensitive knowledge. Well, can I know that they exist while I'm experiencing them? Can I demonstrate that? No, it's not demonstrative, but no one could be so skeptical as to be uncertain of it. Well, how about when I'm not experiencing them? Do they exist? He said, very probably. Okay. Further in his epistemology, what do we know about the objects, the physical objects of our experience? According to Locke, the bodies that are out there cause two kinds of ideas in us, two different kinds of ideas. First, they cause ideas which truly resemble the object, and then they also give us ideas that do not in the least resemble the object. So there's two different kinds of ideas. This glass right here is causing two different kinds of ideas right now in my mind. First, the ideas that truly resemble it. These will be called primary qualities. The primary qualities of this glass truly represent the glass. Primary qualities are its solidity, its extension, its figure, and its mobility. Its solidity, extension, figure, and mobility. Figure, for instance. I know that this glass is of a certain configuration or geometric shape. That idea that is caused in me by this glass actually represents the glass itself, so it's a primary quality. But there are other qualities that other ideas that I have of qualities in this glass which don't resemble the glass at all. For instance, I'm having a sensation of this glass that it is cooler than my hand. Is cooler than my hand something that's in this glass itself? No. I'm also having a sensation of this glass that it is clear in its visual quality. It'd be easier if we had a colored one here. I'd say I'm seeing it as red or green or blue. But I'll just say clear. Now, is the glass actually clear or actually green or actually colder than my hand? No. That is a sensation that comes about through interaction with my sense organs. If there were no sense organs, I wouldn't have those sensations at all. The sensation of colder than Dr. Bonson's hand is not in this glass. That quality is only there if there's a Dr. Bonson sensing the glass. You follow me? Does this remind you of that old aggravating question? If a tree falls in a forest and no one is there any sound? This is where it comes from. If you take sound to be a secondary quality, that is, sound is by its own nature an experienced thing, then if there's no one there to experience it, then there's no sound. That's different from the question, if a tree falls in the forest, are there airwaves of a certain magnitude created? Okay. So those same waves may be there, but if there are no ears to pick up on the waves, there's no sound. Okay, so according to Locke, you have two types of qualities, or if you will, two kinds of ideas in us, primary and secondary qualities. Locke maintained, along with Descartes, that every object has an internal but unknown constitution whereon its discernible qualities depend, and that all properties flow from that essence. I'm just reminding you that he believed in the undiscerned substance. The substance contains the primary and the secondary qualities. The secondary qualities, however, are only qualities in interaction with sense organs. Now, by way of criticism, I would say that it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to hold on to the notion of substance and then turn around and deny that substance can be known. Locke wanted the idea of substance, but he had to admit it's an I know not what. My empirical epistemology cannot verify substance. We already did our analysis of substance. Now what I'm saying is he should have just dismissed the whole idea if he was true to his epistemology. But you see, Locke wouldn't be a consistent empiricist. He still wanted to hold on to the old idea that the world is a rational reality, an objective, rational thing that can be known by the mind of man. His empirical method, the historical plane method, only revealed to him sensations in sequences. But he wanted to go beyond that and make this a rational, objective world that has substances that unite these sensations into apples and glasses and all the rest. I'm going to talk about relations and names before we take a brief break here. Knowledge of relations. According to Locke, I can know the agreement or disagreement between two ideas in my head. That is a knowledge of the relationship between ideas. And of these agreements and disagreements, the most important would be the relationship of identity or diversity on the one hand, and the relationship of coexistence on the other. So when I look at the ideas in my head and how they're related to each other, I see some as identical or diverse. I see some others as coexisting. Okay. I know when I introspect that that green and red are not identical. Okay. There's a relationship of diversity that I know between these two colors. But I have another kind of relationship that I know in my head, and that is the relationship between, I have the idea of iron, and I have the idea of magnetic attraction. From what I've seen, and I notice that the idea of iron and the idea of magnetic attraction always coexist. I know that they're different, but I know that they always coexist. So that Locke, in this way, can lay a foundation for scientific work. He can say, when our ideas of the properties of iron always coexist with our ideas of magnetic attraction, then we can draw the conclusion what? That iron is magnetic, or it is attracted magnetically. In this way, a science of bodies is possible. But it's not a demonstrative science. It's not like what the continental rationalists said. They thought you could have a demonstrative science of bodies. Locke said you can have a science of bodies, but it cannot reach the level of demonstration. It's always just a matter of what ideas coexist in the mind. It is, if you will, adventitious. Remember that word? From a Cartesian standpoint, the science of bodies is always an adventitious, not a demonstrative science. And then the last thing we'll say about his epistemology is his view of names. According to Locke, perhaps the greatest scholarly problem, intellectual problem, that men have is not understanding what a name is. According to him, a name is simply a device to abridge discourse. That is, to shorten the way we say things. A name is simply a way of shortening our description. Now, when you have a group of coexisting ideas, that's what I've just talked to you about, coexisting ideas. That is, when you have a number of properties that are always grouped together, and here are some properties. What are the properties of iron? Okay, a certain solidity, a certain color, and so forth. And when you see that kind of solidity and color and magnetic attraction all coexisting, You give a name to it. Now, why do you give the name iron to that thing? Well, because if you were talking to somebody, you don't want to say, hey, would you go over there and get me some of that solidity colored stuff that's, you know, attracted, you know, to magnets? That would take too long. Okay? Think about it this way. I call on you and I use your name, right? I call on Jay. Now, that's a lot easier than saying, the person who was born in 19 whatever at this particular address and now resides at this address and is a certain height and weight and blah, blah, blah. Instead of telling you all of these particulars that are associated together in my experience, I just summarize all that as what? Jay. Likewise, all the other words we use, all the names that we use are like that. They're just an abridged discourse for all of the ideas that coexist in our mind for something. So it's a matter of convenience when we want to talk. Now, there is nothing else in our experience, no substantial form, if you will, no essence that this name stands for. The name simply stands for coexisting ideas. Now, according to Locke, we give names not only to groups of coexisting ideas, but we can also give a name to a single idea that can be isolated from these groups. The name of an idea that's isolated from the others with which it coexists is called an abstract idea, that is isolated from its context of coexisting ideas. When I speak of something general now, like man, animal, something that ordinarily would have been called a universal, Locke says that's just a general name, something that has been isolated from the coexisting ideas in our head for particular men. It's the name of some specific experience that occurs repeatedly in combination with other specific experiences. Okay, so let me take Chris and Jay here just as a small illustration. I use the name Jay because there is somebody here, and now I have all these coexisting ideas. And I have somebody who is a man, somebody who drives a car, somebody who has certain color hair, somebody da 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 da. I list all those things, and that's Jayness. I call that Jay. Now I look at Chris, and I say, Chris is a man, Chris drives a car, Chris has a certain color of hair, blah, 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 blah. That's Chris. But now notice, I can go and look at the coexisting ideas of Jay, the coexisting ideas of Chris, and I can pull one out that's common to them both, man. And so man is not a universal, it's just a name for an experience quality that I've repeated. I had this experience when I looked at Jay, and I had this experience when I looked at Chris and others, and I isolate that piece out of the coexisting ideas from repeated coexisting ideas, and then I give that the name man. And so Locke has solved the problem of universals, he thinks. Or has he? I know we're going to run out of tape here, so I'll be quick. The bugaboo here is the notion of repeated experience. Well, that's the whole question. If everything is disconnected, we only have separate loose experiences, then nothing is repeated, is it? This empirical attempt to solve the problem of universals doesn't solve it at all. It just transfers the problem. Why is it when I have my coexisting ideas of Jay and my coexisting ideas of Chris that I look at the two sets of ideas and I identify two as identical with each other? I didn't experience identity, did I? What did I experience? A particular thing that I called man and another particular thing I called man. You see, when you deny universals, when you say only particulars exist, you make repeats impossible. You make kinds impossible. You make repeats impossible. Because to say that something has repeated itself is to say you have what? A oneness among the many. You have a commonality among the diversity. But no one experiences commonality. They only experience things diversely on the empirical epistemology. All right, so we've covered the major parts of Locke, his paradigm for the new philosophy, his rejection of innate ideas, his psychology of knowing that all ideas derive from experience, which we have critiqued, and then finally his epistemology and its view of the objects of knowledge, relationships, and names, and we found each of these to be problematic as well. After we take a brief break, I would like to speak to you about something that is equally significant in the philosophical career of Locke, and that is his ethics and his politics. All right, before we finish today, let's take a look at Locke's ethics and then finally his politics. Let me quote. Locke says, "Things are good or evil only in reference to pleasure or pain." And so the ethical problem is just a matter of finding out of all those things that we can do, of all the conduct that's available to us, what line of conduct in a given situation will be productive of the greatest pleasure. All right, so Locke is, theoretically anyway, a hedonist. Hedonism is the view that man's highest good is pleasure. Okay? Locke had to face, though, what in philosophical circles is called the problem of bad will. Bad will. Why is it that people do things that aren't pleasurable? Why do they do bad things? And Locke offered a psychological explanation of this. He said, when people do things, when they pursue things which are not pleasurable but painful, it's because there's been a foreshortening of their perception of the nature of something. This foreshortening or distortion of their vision, if you will, distortion of their judgment, causes the present good or pleasure to seem greater than the more remote good. It seems like it's greater than the more remote good, but it's not. My mistake is not about my present pleasures and pains. I've got that right. But I am mistaken about future pleasures and pains and the relationship to my present ones. Okay? Now, this happens to you. Okay? It's Friday evening, and you have the choice between going to the football game or staying home and reading your philosophy assignment for a test on Monday. Now, passing the philosophy exam, of course, is the thing that's going to give you the greatest pleasure and happiness. But on Friday night, when your friends are calling you to go to the football game, it appears to you that the pleasure of going to the football game is greater than the pleasure of passing the philosophy test. Now, you're not mistaken on Friday night about your present pleasures and pains. Is it true that it is more pleasurable to go to the football game? Is there greater pleasure there than in the pain of reading the philosophy assignment? Yeah, that's true. But what you've made the mistake about, you didn't all have to be so enthusiastic about that. This is only a hypothetical example. What you made a mistake about is the relative pleasure and pain on Monday when you took the test. And so Locke says people do bad things because they have distorted judgment about the relationship between present pleasures and future pains or vice versa. Now, how can we help people not to make those mistakes? Well, that's where law comes in. Law helps us to correct our mistaken judgments about relative pleasures and pains. And according to Locke, there are three kinds of laws. In every kind of law, what you have is a maxim, an axiom, if you will, that condenses experience, summarizes experience for us to give us guidance. First, there's the law of opinion. The law of opinion. You're getting ready to go out the door to the football game, and your roommate says, "Have you done your philosophy reading?" You say, No. I really want to go see this football game. It's going to give me so much pleasure." And then your roommate says, "Yes, but over years of experience in college education, we have generalized that it's better to be responsible and do your homework before you pursue your pleasures." And you say, "Hey, thanks for the good advice. Catch you later." And you're out the door. Okay, there is the law of opinion. And though I'm making fun of it because it doesn't have a lot of, you know, grip on a person, the fact is that the law of opinion does affect us. There are, in our day and age, for instance, politicians, to give you a really cynical example, politicians who will be more cautious about their sexual infidelities. Why? Because they've learned over the experience that, how can we put this, popular opinion will make it hard for you to be reelected if you're known to be an adulterer. Okay? So, the law of opinion does have some grip on us, but it's not determinative, is it? We can take this a step further, though. There's not only the law of opinion, there's civil law. And the difference between opinion, which is a kind of exhortation, if you will, based on experience, you know, it's better to brush your teeth every day if you want to save them. What goes beyond the exhortation, the law of opinion, is the civil law, because it adds not only the maxim of what you should do or not do, I mean, it gives to the maxim of what you should do or not do a penalty. Civil law is set over against public opinion law because it's enforced by the commonwealth. Now, does public opinion law and civil law, do they coincide? No, they do not, but yes, they tend to. You can't say they coincide because, for instance, here's a public opinion law. Brush your teeth if you want to save them. But there's no civil law that requires you to brush your teeth. Okay? So they aren't altogether the same. Nevertheless, when public opinion does represent the popular sentiment, it tends to become civil law. So they are differentiated by one has a penalty, an imposed penalty by the commonwealth, the other does not. But they also have a more positive interaction than that might suggest. They are not in watertight compartments. But then thirdly, Locke said there's also divine law. And I especially like reading this to you. I'm going to give you a paragraph from his writings because of the kind of abuse poor Dr. Bonson takes for promoting divine law in the commonwealth. You know, this theonomic idea that God has revealed himself and that the states must answer to the divine law, many people would say, "Oh, we can't have that. That's tyranny." Well, listen to John Locke, the father of our modern liberty, okay, as most secularists would say. And I quote, "That law which God has set to the actions of men, whether promulgated to them by the light of nature or the voice of revelation," this is what divine law is, "that God has given a rule whereby men should govern themselves, I think there is nobody so brutish as to deny. He has a right to do it. We are his creatures. He has goodness and wisdom to direct our actions to that which is best, and he has power to enforce it by rewards and punishments of infinite weight and duration in another life, for nobody can take us out of his hands. This is the only true touchstone of moral rectitude. And by comparing them to this law, it is that men judge of the most considerable moral good or evil of their actions. That is, whether as duties or sins, they are like to procure them happiness or misery from the hands of the Almighty. Again, Locke had his problems, but he said some good things too. Now, there is a problem in even this we're going to get to. But notice this part. Locke thinks that there are really two different ways to evaluate conduct. One way to evaluate is to ask, does it maximize pleasure? Or are you making a distorted judgment that you think it's more pleasurable to go to the football game, though it means you'll fail your philosophy test? So you can evaluate conduct on the basis of pleasure, or you can evaluate it on the basis of its conformity to divine law. What's the relationship between these two different tests? If you're a Christian, Dr. Bonson's a Christian, and this may surprise you, I happen to be a hedonist too. Of course, I've got a special definition of pleasure. But what do you think Locke would say the relationship of pleasure to divine law is? Well, because he believes that God created this universe, he also believes that the most pleasurable way to live is what? To obey the divine law. I believe that. In fact, if any of you have been properly raised on the shorter catechism, you believe it too. What is the chief end of man? Is the answer to glorify God forever? No, it's to glorify God and to what? Enjoy Him forever. Man's chief end is pleasure. But of course, that's not divorced from the glory of God. But nor is the glory of God divorced from man's pleasure. And so, from a Christian standpoint, we can say we ought to do that which will bring the greatest pleasure. And men make mistakes in estimating their pleasures, and therefore we'd better follow the divine law if we really want to be happy. Well, unfortunately, Locke didn't quite take that approach, though. He did believe that God established His law for man's best interest. That is, the long-range, greatest positive good or pleasure for man is laid down in the law of God. Ideally, then, the law of opinion and the civil law should be brought to correspond with divine law. And if civil law were to correspond to divine law, the chances for men's happiness would be increased. And so Locke preferred a political theory that has a state organization most likely to bring civil law into conformity with divine law. All of that I like. Locke indicates that he wants to establish a state where it's most conducive to bringing civil law, which looks for the pleasure of men and reinforces it, into line with divine law. But here's the kicker. For Locke, how do we discover what the commands of the divine law are that bind the state? How do we discover what the divine law is? See, he's got the framework right. Divine law should be the model or ideal toward which civil law moves. He's got that right. But how do you know the divine law? Well, what if you were a Protestant like Luther? How do you know God's will? Read the Bible. What if you're a Roman Catholic? Follow church tradition. If you're John Locke and one of these Renaissance-type thinkers, morality has to be put on a rational basis. And so the principles of morality are capable of demonstration. And so what Locke says is, we've got to bring the state in line with divine law, and divine law is found through the application of reason. See, that's the kicker. Where Dr. Bonson says, why don't we just skip this perverted, fallen, and fallible process of reasoning and just go right to the back of the book for the correct answers? You know what I mean by the back of the book method? those of you who take my logic course will find out that certain homework exercises in Copy's book have been answered at the back of the book so that you can kind of check yourself as you go along. Well, what I'm saying is I'm one of those guys who says, look, why don't we just go to the back of the book and get it right? Locke wants to try to reason out what the divine law is. I'm saying God's told us right here in the pages of this book. Why don't we use it? And so Locke looks for certain rational principles of morality that reflect the divine law. But as someone like W.T. Jones points out, unfortunately, the ones that he comes up with as being rational truths turn out to be trivial because they're tautological. They're only logical truths. Here's an example. Locke says, no government allows absolute liberty. No government allows absolute liberty. You say, oh, hey, that's a significant principle for statecraft. No, it's not. It's true by definition. Government means what? Restriction. Liberty means no restriction, so no government can be absolutely no government. That is, you can't have a government that is absolutely not a government. It's just true by definition, it turns out. So what Locke took to be his eternal truths, the divine law, really disguised logical tautologies that are trivial and not very helpful. Despite his empirical epistemology, Locke wanted to hold to the essential rationality of the universe. And he believed that the rationality of the universe expressed itself in eternal truths of morality. And he believed that man is part of this rational cosmos and can understand those rational truths by using his reason. But the problem is Locke's plain historical method cannot deal with universal and necessary truths, can it? Because the plain historical method looks for the origin of ideas, and the only thing we can go to are particulars. The only way to get universality in a world where we can only know particulars is by a decree of some power. Leviathan, if you're Hobbes, God, if you're Locke. But the main thing that I want you to see is that when Locke argued that there are laws of nature, if you will, that bind all men, and he becomes famous for the political theory that arises